journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, August 31st, 2010, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Chip Berlay on Beck's honor rally and right-wing tactics. John DeGraff on a progressive strategy to improve the economy. Work less so all can work. And Sikibo Hutchinson on the LA Times' new series on public school teacher evaluations. This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Fox News shock jock Glenn Beck's so-called honor rally over the weekend in Washington, D.C. drew, according to Beck, between 300,000 to 650,000 people. Ultra-conservative Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann insisted that more than a million people were present. But CBS News hired a firm that estimated the crowd at less than 100,000. The rally was held on the same day and location as the 1963 historic March for Jobs and Freedom, where Martin Luther King Jr. gave his legendary I Have a Dream speech, attracting more than 200,000 Americans. While Beck insisted that his rally was held on that day coincidentally, he has spoken about reclaiming the civil rights movement. In his only post-rally interview on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace, Beck apologized for calling Obama a racist who hates white people about a year ago. But he went on to criticize the president's religious views, saying that they were based on liberation theology. The honor rally was advertised as being non-political and focused on honoring U.S. troops, but many attendees identified as members of the Tea Party movement that has assailed President Obama as a dangerous socialist. Beck himself did not mention Obama or Speaker of the House Pelosi, and instead used heavily religious language, calling on Americans to, quote, turn to God. The rally is the latest expression of right-wing hysteria that seems to be sweeping some factions of American society. At stake is the political balance in Congress with the approaching midterm elections. Republicans are hoping to make big gains in November, buoyed by the fever pitch of today's right-wing rhetoric. But what is often unsaid is how a handful of billionaires are bankrolling the extreme right and public events like Beck's Honor Rally. My guest is Chip Berlay. He's with Political Research Associates. Welcome to Uprising, Chip.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. So you've written a lot about right-wing populism and right-wing religious fervor for many years now. It seems as though your work is going to have many, many opportunities in this era when the right-wing is so active. First, let's talk about the disappointing turnout. What do you make of the fact that the numbers are being inflated to 500,000 when it was probably less than 100,000, at best half the size of the 1963 March, at a time when, you know, the right wing has the entire gamut of electronic communication at their fingertips? Should progressives and reasonable Americans worry about this puny showing?
Well, turn it on its head. 100,000 people is a lot of people, and that a bunch of blowhards are trying to inflate it like a, you know, balloon, that's pretty common. So, you know, yeah, okay, the numbers worked out so that the King March had a lot more people, but a lot more people were willing to go to big rallies back in the 1960s and 1970s, and now not so much. Even on the left, the anti-war movement has a hard time turning folks out, although the mainstream media ignores the turnouts when they are large. Same with all kinds of other immigrant rights rallies and abortion rights rallies. So what we have here is a glass half empty or half full question. And the question is, what's really going on? Is this a real grassroots movement? And it is. It started out as AstroTurf. It probably started out when Ron Paul raised a ton of money using the Tea Party trope as a kind of theme to raise the money, and got picked up by elites like Dick Armey and, you know, a bunch of corporate and spin doctor Republican operatives, then created a fake grassroots campaign built around these issues, and it took off and Now there are hundreds of thousands of people active in the Tea Party movement, according to a study by Leonard Zeskind and his friends. And, you know, millions of Americans think highly of them. So let's look at the latest Gallup poll that says the Democrats' disadvantage in this coming November election is the highest ratio of disapproval for a president in office and for Democratic potential candidates since Gallup started keeping the records.
I want to talk about the elections in just a moment, but let's stay on Beck for a little bit. He apologized, as I mentioned earlier, for calling Obama a racist on Sunday, and then he proceeded to attack Obama's religious views. Let's play an excerpt of Fox News Sunday where Beck was asked about the comments that he had made about Obama a year ago.
What I didn't understand at the time was the influences on President Obama. And, you know, the white culture, read his own books. He writes about the white culture and how he struggled with it, et cetera, et cetera. But I didn't understand really his theology. His viewpoints come from liberation theology. That's what I think at the gut level I was sensing. And I miscast it as racism, and really what it is liberation theology.
Do you, I know you've said it, but I mean, do you, and in this context, in this forum, do you regret having called him a racist and saying he had a deep-seated hatred for white people?
Of course I do. I don't want to retract the, I want to amend that I think it is much more of a theological question, that he is a guy who understands the world through liberation theology, which is oppressor and victim. Racist was, first of all, it shouldn't have been said. It was poorly said. I have a big fat mouth sometimes and I say things, and that's just not the way people should behave. And it was not accurate. It is liberation theology that has shaped his worldview.
And that is Glenn Beck speaking on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace. My guest is Chip Burleigh, senior analyst with Political Research Associates. Chip, what do you make of this apology, quote unquote?
No, it's not an apology. It's bogus. And what he's simply done is swapped an appeal to naked white supremacy to a coded appeal to white supremacy, because he put his finger on it. A liberation theology, which I practice as a Christian, thank you, is about oppression. And it's about speaking truth to power and exposing who has unfair power and privilege in this society. And basically Beck and a lot of people on the right these days are using coded language to suggest that white people are the victims, not the oppressor. And they're casting liberation theology accurately as saying who has the power and who has the privilege and how can we redistribute it to be more equitable. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty accurate description of liberation theology.
In fact, I want to quote what Beck said about liberation theology in his own show last week. He said, "You see, it's all about victims and victimhood, oppressors and the oppressed, reparations, not repentance, collectivism, not individual salvation. I don't know what that is other than it's not Muslim, it's not Christian, it's a perversion of the gospel of Jesus Christ as most Christians know it." End of quote. Now, aside from calling it a perversion of Christianity, I think you're right, he did seem to nail it. Liberation theology is about collective salvation, not individual, but this reflects a standard right-wing ideology of every man for himself.
Well, absolutely, and it goes back to the Bella idea of civil religion, civic religion, the idea that America is built on piety, patriotism, and rugged individualism, and the kind of Calvinism on crack. And so it's basically, you know, arguing in favor of unfair distribution of wealth and power in the society and keeping it, the coded aspect is keeping it in the hands of the people who should have it, which are apparently straight white Christian men.
Hmm. So in this particular attack on liberation theology, what do you think the price is going to be for Glenn Beck launching these attacks? I mean, are African Americans and others who, and many Latino Americans as well, who and progressives who practice liberation theology, are they hearing what Beck is saying, and will there be any kind of a backlash?
Well, I think that most Catholic and Protestant people of color who practice some form of liberation theology, whether they call it that or not, are going to simply laugh and say that the man's a joke. See, Glenn Beck isn't talking to them. He's trying to appeal to a white audience and give a white audience a cover for their anxiety and fear over the growing number of people of color in the country and the fact that a black man, a mixed-race black man, is president. And so what we have here is competing frames, as sociologists would say. You know, how do you build a white backlash in a political moment without appearing to be nakedly racist? And the answer is Glenn Beck.
Now, he also talks about reclaiming the civil rights movement. I mean, to me, this is just an enormous slap in the face of the civil rights community.
It completely is. I mean, I got into my politics through the civil rights movement, through the church. I was a Presbyterian, and I got involved in what was happening around Martin Luther King by reading a letter from Birmingham Jail. So if you read what King writes, and if you look at the transcripts of his speeches, you'll see that he, in fact, invokes the vision of an America where all Americans are working together to build a better democracy, a better future for our families and our neighborhoods, and you know, speaking truth to power and seeing equalization as of unfair power and privilege and distributing it wider as a goal. And he also began to speak out on economic matters, and he began to speak out against the war in Vietnam. So this is, in fact, the opposite of what the right-wing policy ideas are right now. I mean, if you look at the upcoming Values Voters Conference in Washington in a couple of weeks, I mean, you know, right at the top of their page, it's rise to the challenge, rally to the cause. Well, what's the cause? Here's the list. Protect marriage, champion life, strengthen the military, limit government, control spending, and defend our freedoms. Now, okay, let's translate that into progressive speak. Shove gay people back into the closet, force women back into back alleys to get abortion, fight Islam around the world with tanks and bombs, strip the government of its role as, you know, a social service safety net, and defend our freedom simply means defend the notion that America is a Christian nation and that's how it's supposed to be and everyone else can go, you know, suck their thumb.
So let's talk about both the Values Voters Conference and the November elections. The conference is taking place in mid-September, and these sorts of conferences and summits by the right wing are seeing a greater attendance. The right wing appears to be overly energized, and Republicans are, according to many news reports, already popping the champagne bottles in anticipation of making huge gains this November. Earlier, you mentioned a Gallup poll that showed bad news for Democrats and President Obama. What do you think is going to happen in November?
Well, I can't guess. And I've been talking with both Republican and Democratic polling and spin people for some time just because we love to share little tidbits. And everyone I know who's a serious student of these matters shrugs their shoulders and said, it's too volatile. The Tea Party movement is too fractured at this moment to guess whether it'll hold together even for another 8, 9, or 10 weeks. So I can't predict the future. I can say that the indicators are piling up that there is going to be a huge get-out-the-vote campaign. It's going to be built around the frames that Beck and the Values Voters people are talking about. And you know, given the anger at the government and the failure of the economy to recover for a lot of middle-class people, especially white working-class and middle-class people, you know, it could be very grim for the Democrats. But remember, the point here is a coalition of economic libertarians and the Christian right and, you know, militarists. These are people who are targeting gay people and abortion rights and scapegoating Muslims and Mexican immigrants, and they can get on the same page despite their differences, and yet the Democratic Party has failed to lead any kind of progressive social movement to push back. And so it's up to radical activists on the left to stand up and say, you know, this is not acceptable, and try and do something to change it if that's what they want to do. And I'm speaking for myself now. You know, it's scaring me.
Chip Berlet is my guest. He's a senior analyst with Political Research Associates. Now, let's talk about the handful of billionaires, three in particular, that are funding and astroturfing the Tea Party movement and the essentially the entire right-wing hysteria machine. Frank Rich wrote about it in the New York Times, and I understand you're going to be writing about it in an upcoming issue of In These Times. Rupert Murdoch and the Koch brothers, is that basically it? These three men who are billionaires who are bankrolling a movement to reduce, to essentially dismantle government?
Well, yeah, that's a great storyline, and like many media storylines, it's not true. There has been, for the past 40 years, a concerted effort by conservatives of a variety of sectors, libertarian and Christian right and pro-military and others, to fund strategically and to build social and political structures that pull the Republican Party to the right. This has been well documented. It was first documented by a number of nonprofit study groups all the way back to the 1970s. It was in a book called Roads to Dominion by Sarah Diamond that came out decades ago. So this is nothing new. I think the problem here is that that kind of storyline gives the impression that if it wasn't for a bunch of billionaires and millionaires giving money to a handful of operatives, there would be no right-wing movement in America. And that's just nonsense. There's been a right-wing movement in America before it was America, when it was a colony.
But maybe they wouldn't have a bullhorn like Fox News, and maybe they wouldn't be as powerful.
Maybe, but, you know, let's take a look at the fact that liberal and left foundations give away more money every year than right-wing foundations, except the left-wing foundations hand out Band-Aids and the right-wing foundations train surgeons.
It's a good way of putting it. So essentially, the onus is on progressives to take charge and do what they can to change the balance of power. Finally, I want to ask you one final question about Glenn Beck. He's a Mormon, and for him to put out this, hold this honor rally that has very strong religious message, it's been interesting to sort of see the conversations in the religious right about Glenn Beck. What sort of conversations are happening among those people who see him as promoting, quote, a false god? And what does that mean about the right's ability to make strategic alliances between differing opinions?
Well, it means that they've really honed the skill of creating projects, as Sarah Diamond wrote, where on any given issue they form a short-term tactical alliance, but with a strategic goal in mind. And so, you know, instead of drumming people out of their movement when there's a disagreement, they simply agree to disagree and move forward on the greater strategic goal of rolling back the social safety net created by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And so, you know, the goal is to turn back the clock to before Roosevelt built the kind of government social safety net that every other industrialized nation in the world has. That's the goal. Strategically, there are alliances that are fractures. Obviously, there's a lot of antipathy still in the Christian evangelical movement against Mormons, and it creates a problem. But let's be clear, Glenn Beck's brand of Mormonism, has been rejected by the Church of Latter-day Saints because Beck bases his view, his theological political view, on a book and a series of studies and even, you know, the Overton. I mean, this is not Mormonism as articulated by the Church of Latter-day Saints. This is Mormonism tainted by a conspiracy theory generated by the John Birch Society in the late 1950s and 1960s. And that's what we're seeing. Conspiracy theories that scapegoat people of color, women, Muslims, Mexicans, gay people, as a vehicle to mobilize white, scared and anxious and economically stressed white working people and white middle class people. That's what's going on. It's been going on for 30 years very effectively. And the Democrats' solution is to call them idiots, lunatics, nutcases, and send a check to the Democratic Party. Don't send a check to the Democratic Party if you want to change America. Get out in the street and organize.
Well, on that note, Chip Berlea, as always, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Chip Berlea is a senior analyst at Political Research Associates. And Chip, what is your blog website that they can read your blog?
Well, I'm publicye.org. Publicye.org is sort of the gateway for my screeds. But, you know, I post on Talk to Action and Huffington Post and Alternet. So, you know, I'm sort of floating around.
Publicye.org, then. I want to thank you again so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Chip Berlea is a senior analyst at Political Research Associates. He's been studying the extreme right for over 25 years, has written several books and blogs regularly. You can find out more about his work at publicye.org, publicye.org. This is Uprising. We're going to turn next to Mumia Abu-Jamal, an award-winning journalist and death row political prisoner who filed a commentary recently about Beck's honor rally. After that, John DeGraff will join us to talk about a strategy for progressives to take back the economy. And then finally, we'll speak with Sikivu Hutchinson about the LA Times series on teacher evaluations.
Honor rallies after war. Huge flags are unfurled, and leading national voices call for patriotism and more honor for the nation's troops. God is invoked on behalf of nationalism and militarism. What seems unsaid under hoopla and song is the suspicion that perhaps the military has been engaged in something dishonorable. As the U.S. combat role in Iraq appears to be winding down, few can call the war a wise option. Fewer still can claim it made the U.S. or the region safer or more stable. Many years ago, at the close of World War I, Germany's veterans returned, bitter about their loss and angry about the humiliations imposed on Germany by the Treaty of Versailles. As a direct response, vets groups and right-wing forces staged mass demonstrations for the military, praising them and calling for more honor for the troops, more national unity, and more faith in German arms and God. These rallies, called Volkstauertag, or Day of National Mourning, so strengthened the hand of the right that it led to the rise of the Nazis, a new world war, and global carnage. As they marched across Europe, many Nazis had the words "Gott mit uns" on their belt buckles, German for "God is with us." Question: what is more honorable, a soldier who blindly obeys his political and military leaders and commits atrocities, or one who refuses to follow improper, illegal, or inhumane orders? Which one will receive medals, and which one will receive punishment? Which soldier brings more honor to the nation? From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And you can read more of Mumia's commentaries and listen to them online at prisonradio.org. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Conservative commentator Ben Stein wrote last week that the unemployed are a group of unskilled complainers and malcontents. Around the same time, former newspaper editor Ira Stoll called for cutting unemployment benefits for many so-called undeserving groups, including married individuals whose spouses have a job. And in Sunday's Wall Street Journal, Harvard economist Robert Barrow blamed unemployment benefits for keeping unemployment high. It seems as though a new attack on the jobless is always on the horizon, even as economic forecasts remain bleak. But this blame-the-victim mentality is uniquely American when compared to the attitudes of other developed nations. In France, Germany, and the Netherlands, governments discourage layoffs by temporarily subsidizing wages and allowing companies to cut pay. or individuals work less hours, jobs are shared, and the government steps in with subsidies. In Germany, it's called short work, and the French say work less so all can work. My guest, John de Graaf, wrote an article for the latest issue of the Progressive magazine detailing these more flexible approaches to economic downturns. Not surprisingly, he finds that not only do businesses remain productive and competitive in the world market, but workers are happier. John de Graaf is the executive director of Take Back Your Time and the co-author of Affluenza, the All-Consuming Epidemic. He now joins me on the phone. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you. Good to be on your show.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, as we're approaching Labor Day, we're going to see commentaries in the newspaper about the state of labor, about employment, et cetera, and, well, the lack of employment here in this country. How uniquely American is it that we have this approach to work ethic that involves just working harder and harder and harder and somehow making do with less pay, almost no vacation or sick leave?
Well, I think we've accepted that, and we have the philosophy that we shouldn't mandate anything from business, and that will do terrible things for the economy if we restrict our business in any way or its operations. And I think it does make us very, very unique. It doesn't mean that Americans love to work. That, I think, is one of the myths that's been out there, that all of this is voluntary, the long hours that Americans have put in and so forth. In fact, when you look at the Gallup poll, the daily Gallup poll, for example, it finds that Americans are 20% happier on weekends than on work days. They're 30 to 40% happier on holidays than work days. The polling finds that, in fact, the work day is one of the time spent at work is one of the least enjoyable activities for Americans, second lowest only to the morning commute, which is kind of the mother of all downers for people, but we just have refused to do things that every other industrial country in the world, and in fact most small and developing countries do, including things like family leave, paid sick days, obviously paid vacation time, and now in Europe various kinds of work shortening schemes in order to spread the work around.
Well, give us an example of one of these. Let's talk about France. I really like this slogan of work less so all can work. What exactly does that mean? I mean, my first instinct is, does that mean that, you know, people should work 30 hours instead of 40, but then do they get paid for only 30 hours versus 40?
Well, in France, they adopted the 35-hour work week in 1999 for 40 hours pay, so there was no drop in pay. That has been somewhat controversial, though it did actually decrease France's unemployment rate by at least a couple of points, and it still lasts. People mostly really like the 35-hour work week, despite some of the business complaints about it. There is a change now where if both employers and employees agree, people can work 39 hours a week. And what that is in France is it's spread out over the year. It doesn't mean you can only work 35 hours in 1 week, but over the course of the year's work, you can't average more than 35 hours. So some people work 40 hours a week or even more, but then they get much more vacation time. I have a cousin in Paris who works 41 hours a week on average, but he gets 10 weeks of vacation, another 5 weeks added to the 5 weeks that he already gets by law. So, that's how the French do it. I don't think it's necessarily the most effective way to do these things. I really like the approaches in Germany and the Netherlands better.
Well, tell us what Germany and the Netherlands do that's different.
Well, one thing that Germany has done is a program called Short Work, as you mentioned, or Kurzarbeit is the German term for it. And what they do is they encourage companies during recessionary times to, instead of laying off workers, to shorten hours and keep workers on, and then they top up the workers' salaries using unemployment funds. Some states in the United States allow this, but unfortunately their budgets are often too low, and they need federal support, and the federal government does not allow the use of unemployment except when people are laid off completely. The result of this program is that Germany has actually didn't really see any increase in unemployment, only the tiniest increase in unemployment during the recession, and now unemployment in Germany is actually lower than before the recession started, and the economy is doing quite well. The Netherlands has a different approach, which is now also adopted in Germany. It's called the Hours Adjustment Act. And what that does, I think it's one of the best approaches of all, it allows workers to actually reduce their working hours if they want more time with their family, if they want various other kinds of things. and they keep their benefits prorated, they keep their health care, they keep their hourly salary. And so often people who are maybe earning a little more but have a time in their life when they really need the time can make this choice and not lose their jobs, not lose their health care, all of those kinds of things. I think this program has worked very, very well. The Northern Netherlands has a very low unemployment rate. It has the highest percentage of part-time workers in the world, but those part-time workers are not stigmatized and they earn decent wages. They have good benefits, and it's a model that's spreading to other places as well.
Now, here in the United States, it's essentially a fact that a person working full-time at minimum wage cannot afford an apartment in pretty much any city in the United States.
Absolutely not. And that is the other shame here, is that we have not seen any increase in real wages for workers since about the mid-70s. And for, of course, the people in the minimum wage, they've seen a real reduction in real wages. So in advocating shorter work time, I'm not suggesting that we not pay attention to issues like the minimum wage. I think we need to increase the minimum wage. It's not as high in real terms now as it was in 1968, for example. But I'm also advocating various forms of paid leave for people, which would benefit also poor workers, because if they had paid time off when they had a child, that would be an advantage because it's paid. Paid vacations. We see about 30% of low-income workers who don't get any paid vacation time at all. This is utterly unusual. There are only essentially five countries in the world that don't require paid vacations by law, and those countries are the United States, Guyana, Suriname, Nepal, and that paragon of human rights, Burma. That's it. Every other country requires paid vacation time for workers. So many of the things I'm talking about in terms of the paid leave options, of parental leave, sick days, we have 40% of American workers who get no sick days at all, 86% of restaurant workers. This is unheard of.
And even things like maternity leave and parental leave in general.
Parental leave, California and New Jersey are the only states that have any paid parental leave by law. The rest of the country doesn't have it. Now, there are only four countries in the world that don't require paid maternity leave by law, and those four countries are the United States, Liberia, Swaziland, and Papua New Guinea. So again, that's how unique we are. There are only a handful of countries that don't require paid sick days. The United States is just absolutely unusual. We think it's great and that it makes our economy huge and that we have the grossest domestic product and all of these kind of things. But the fact is that it's not good for workers, and ultimately it's not good for society as a whole. Certainly not good for our health, and it certainly adds to the expense of health care in the United States. I mean, we're spending half the world's health care budget. We're spending twice as much on health care per person as any other country in the world, and yet arguably we have the worst outcomes in the industrial world, the shortest life expectancy, the worst infant mortality, the worst maternal mortality, the highest obesity. If you grow up in the United States, you are twice as likely after age 50 to suffer from chronic illnesses like heart disease and type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, and so forth, as you would be if you lived in Europe, because I would argue of our stressful, overworked society. Overwork in America really has become the new tobacco. It has that kind of effect on our health.
Well, just listening to you is kind of depressing. My guest is John DeGraff. He's the executive director of Take Back Your Time and co-author of Affluenza, the All-Consuming Epidemic. And definitely check out his cover story in this week, latest issue of The Progressive, where he talks about a progressive strategy to improve the economy, work less so that more can work, and any of these various strategies that other countries, particularly in Europe, have used to successfully lower unemployment and perhaps have a happier society. So I want to go back to this issue of the fact that we have such low pay. Would you say in the United States, in order to implement such a strategy so that people work a little bit less, it has to go hand in hand with increasing hourly pay?
I think it certainly does for a large segment of the population. I think there's no question about that. you know, it depends on how much people are making. And the problem with the United States is we are so stratified, and we have people making very high incomes, and then we have a large number of people who are extremely poor. So I think having a living wage as part of this is absolutely essential. Mm-hmm. If you look at the European countries, in most of these cases, the minimum wages in these countries approach $12 an hour. In some cases, they're even higher than $12 an hour. Those people don't pay particularly high taxes because they are the low. They pay taxes, but they don't pay as the high tax rates that we see in Europe because they are low-income people. But they get many other benefits, you know, free education, free health care, and so forth. So absolutely, I don't want to make light of the situation of those Americans who are subsisting on very, very low wages. They simply cannot reduce their hours without an increase in pay. But, you know, again, the situation is not the same for everyone, and I think we need to be thinking along both these lines. But we need to understand that we cannot keep growing and growing as we are. We cannot assume that when we have increases in productivity and those cause automation and those cause the loss of jobs, that we will always make up for those jobs by adding more and more work at 40 and 50 and 60 hours a week.
Now, John, senators in Rhode Island and Connecticut have sponsored a bill that would allow federal unemployment to be used to fill in salary gaps when hours are reduced. Do you see this as a step toward the kind of system that you hope to see in the U.S.?
Oh, absolutely. I think what they're talking about is an American model of the German Kurzarbeit system.
Mm-hmm.
The economist Dean Baker, the progressive economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, has advocated that any new stimulus package include a sizable amount of money for a Kurzarbeit or shared work program to allow people to reduce hours but not lose their salaries, and therefore to make more workplaces in the economy. Now, the interesting thing about this is that Dean Baker is a progressive economist. He testified in favor of this in Barney Frank's House Financial Services Committee for this bill by the Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island and Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro. But also testifying in favor of the bill, very surprisingly, was Kevin Hassett, who is an economist for the conservative American Enterprise Institute. And Hassett said, you know, why wouldn't we do this? It works in Germany. It's worked for employers, it's worked for employees, and it really doesn't cost a whole lot more.
Well, finally, let's talk about the fact that less work means more life, as you talk about in your article, and the fact that Americans are 20% happier on weekends than on workdays, but that is certainly no surprise. Not only would Americans be healthier, but likely happier if they simply worked less but kept their same pay? Or got a raise.
Yeah. I think there's no question that we could have both a happier and certainly healthier and more sustainable society, because we simply cannot grow on forever. I mean, if we try to solve everything through growth, we're going to make the Gulf of Mexico oil spill look like a picnic. I mean, it's just we are running into severe ecological limits, so we can have a better life in that sense, but we'll also be healthier. I mean, there's no question. One of the strange things we see is that when we have a recession in the United States, health actually improves, and part of that is because people, although they have, in a sense, less money, they have more time, and they exercise more. They grow some of their own food. They eat out, you know, less food in restaurants and things. They drive less and actually walk and bicycle more. So we see fewer traffic accident deaths. We see an improvement in air quality. We see less children's asthma and other respiratory illnesses. We're seeing that in this recession. I mean, that's one of the strange an ironic bright spots of the recession. Now, that doesn't mean we want the kind of unemployment and the suffering that we have in this recession. It just means that when we go back to full employment, we should find a different way to do that so people can keep their health and they can keep having the time to volunteer and to grow some of their own food and to share quality experiences with other people. This is what life needs to be about, not producing so much.
Definitely would have to agree with you. I certainly would like to be working less myself. John DeGraff, where can listeners find out more about your work? Is there a website?
Yeah, the website for my organization, Take Back Your Time, is www.timeday.org. So that's one place to go. You'll find out there, too, about our national campaign for a paid vacation law. And that bill is sponsored by Alan Grayson, the Democrat of Florida. It was introduced last year that would give the workers who don't receive any vacation time at least a modest amount of vacation time.
So timeday.org, and listeners can certainly check out the latest issue of The Progressive for your cover story. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much. Take care.
You too. John DeGraff is executive director of Take Back Your Time, which is online at timeday.org. He's also the co-author of Affluenza, the All-Consuming Epidemic, and his article in The Progressive is called Working Less So All Can Work, A Strategy for Progressive. This is Uprising, and before we go to a short break, I want to remind you that we're about to launch an outreach campaign to get the word out about this program and KPFK. If you liked what you just heard on Uprising, wish more people could listen to this kind of programming. There are still far too many people in Southern California who've never tuned into this show and to this station. KPFK is listener-sponsored. We don't have a big budget to sponsor massive billboards like Clear Channel, but we do have dedicated listeners like you, and if you'd like to volunteer a few hours of your time to be part of our outreach team, you can email us at mail@uprisingradio.org. That's mail@uprisingradio.org. Or you can call our volunteer coordinator, Jesse, at 818-985-2711, extension 513. That's 818-985-2711, extension 513. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Sikivu Hutchinson, senior fellow at the Institute for Humanist Studies and editor of blackfemlens.org, will join us to critique the LA Times series on teacher evaluations. Stay tuned.
Become a member of your favorite radio station. Log on now to kpfk.org.
This Thursday, September 2nd, the Grammy Museum will commemorate the 40th anniversary of Miles Davis's jazz-funk-rock masterpiece, Bitches Brew. Ranked as one of the greatest albums of all time, Bitches Brew is widely regarded as his jazz-rock-funk masterpiece, which changed the course of music. Panelists include host Bubba Jackson, special guests Henry Rollins, DJ Jeremy Soule, KPFK's own Maggie LaPique, and members of the Miles Davis family. That's this Thursday, September 2nd, 7:30 p.m. at the Grammy Museum at 800 West Olympic Boulevard in downtown Los Angeles. RSVP at programs@grammymuseum.org. More details at kpfk.org. KPFK is a proud media sponsor.
This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. In a controversial new series of articles, the Los Angeles Times has begun evaluating Los Angeles Unified School District teachers using a new grading system. This so-called value-added analysis attempts to explain student test scores by comparing the student with him or herself, as opposed to the presently used Academic Progress Index, or API, which compares students to their peers. The Times and proponents of this system claim that it mitigates many of the socioeconomic discrepancies that have dogged the accuracy of standardized testing since its genesis. Value-added analysis follows students for years and compares the results of these individuals against their previous scores. The data presented by the Times suggests that teachers can have an incredible impact on their students' learning, swaying average scores by as much as 20 to 30 percentile points in just a single year. In addition to renewing the debate on measuring student achievement, the series calls into question the idea of what a successful school is. Many distinguished schools in the LAUSD are actually the worst in the district at raising test scores. Most incendiary of all, though, is the Times' decision to publish the value-added scores of all 6,000 teachers across the district. The teachers' union, UTLA, has urged a boycott of the LA Times in the wake of the series and has scheduled a demonstration outside the Times' office on September 14th. Joining me on the phone this morning is Sikivu Hutchinson, a senior fellow at the Institute for Humanist Studies and editor of blackfemlens.org. RG. Welcome to Uprising, Sikivu.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, let's talk about the fact that test scores in and of themselves, the API system, is obviously one that is flawed because it's based on these standardized tests. But isn't this method that the Times is using also essentially based on test scores?
Absolutely. The Times is basing it on the California standards test and looking at the test scores that third, fourth, and fifth graders got on those tests.
Hmm. And so are those California standardized tests any different or better or worse than the API?
Well, they're actually factored into the API, and I would like to say that if we look at the whole regime of high-stakes testing holistically, researchers from across the spectrum have condemned the institutionalization of high-stakes testing as the linchpin for assessing students and for assessing teacher performance. And I think that the controversy that has erupted around the publication of these scores and the vilification of teachers really dovetails with the national conversation that has emerged around the scapegoating of teachers vis-a-vis the so-called achievement gap, or what Gloria Ladson-Billings has called the education debt with regard to disenfranchised students of color. And the initiatives that we're seeing coming from the federal government under the Obama administration and the leadership of Arne Duncan with regard to Race to the Top have really put teachers and schools under the gun with regard to performing to the highest bar on these high-stakes tests, which are disproportionately impacting the learning outcomes of students of color.
Now, the LA Times says that they think that this method that they've published empowers parents to make better decisions, including, you know, parents of color and low-income parents. And they cite schools like Esperanza Elementary, whose API score is very low, but who has managed to improve their test scores and their children's students' test scores pretty significantly, which implies, according to the LA Times, that Esperanza is actually an up-and-coming school that is doing very well.
That may be the case, but I think, again, if we look at this comprehensively, that this fetishization of high-stakes testing is absolutely detrimental to the long-term outcomes of students of color, particularly when we look at the conditions within urban classrooms with respect to the degree to which students of color are being pushed out of classrooms and schools due to the institutionalization of high-stakes tests, the degree to which students of color are not being engaged in a culturally responsive manner in classrooms, the degree to which classroom management is really being organized around the prescription and the imposition of this high-stakes testing regime.
But in the, with the, you know, if there is no standard, not that I'm defending testing and standardized testing, but barring any other simple and easy way to numerically quantify the health of a school, is there a way to do it without while avoiding the use of test scores?
The push has been amongst progressive educators and progressive reform activists for more holistic, more culturally responsive means of assessment, and not just for students, but also for teachers, looking at lesson plans, looking at writing analyses, looking at the ways in which teachers structured their classes to be non-hierarchical, to be collaborative, to instill leadership and collegiality and civility and a sense of community amongst students, to look at the degree to which students are actively participating within the leadership ethos and discourse within their school communities. So I think that the criticism of value added is not just saying we're going to kick all standardized testing to the curb, but is really looking at, again, the way that these tests have been fetishized within the entire apparatus of public education, and looking at the corollary effects of that vis-a-vis this nationwide epidemic that we have, particularly among African-American students, of suspension, of expulsion, of zero-tolerance, exclusionary discipline practices that contribute to the school-to-prison pipeline that we know is epidemic, again, in communities of color nationwide.
Now, what do you make of the Times' decision to publish all of the value-added assessments of LAUSD teachers, prompting the UTLA to urge a boycott of the paper?
I think, again, that it fuels this vilification that we see of teachers, the scapegoating of teachers, the degree to which teachers are being fixated upon as the cornerstone for the downfall of public education. And again, we have teachers that have been deemed to be highly competent, caring, culturally responsive, well-regarded by their peers, their colleagues within the school community, and by parents who have been exposed as de facto ineffective by one very narrow and reductive criterion of what constitutes a quote-unquote good teacher.
Have you found instances where teachers been considered, you know, very good but then received a low score from the LA Times or vice versa?
Yes, there was a case that was spotlighted that I'm personally familiar with through a family friend, a teacher named Karen Caruso, who teaches at Third Street Elementary School, and she's actually a nationally board certified teacher, again, very well regarded by parents within the school community. And this is a teacher who has been, quote unquote, outed, you know, as an ineffective teacher based upon this, again, very narrow and reductive value added criterion.
Sikivu Hutchinson is my guest. She's the editor of blackfemlens.org and a senior fellow at the Institute for Humanist Studies. We're talking about the LA Times' new series on teacher evaluations. Now, let's talk about race to the top again. California did not get its grant from its federal grant from Obama's Race to the Top initiative. Do you think that in the long term that's a good thing?
Well, I think that teachers have definitely raised, excuse me, a very valid point of contention, you know, with regard to the kind of, again, criteria that the federal government is imposing upon school districts to qualify for that funding, that the Race to the Top is a competition, that it's predicated upon the imposition of national standards, national content standards. It's predicated, again, upon ramping up the presence of high-stakes testing.
And so the Race to the Top initiative, basically, these grants came with a whole bunch of strings attached.
Yes.
And California district administrators were happy to bend over backwards, if I may characterize it that way, to try to qualify for these grants, and they have not qualified for it. And also, part of the getting these grants, as far as I understand, is the increase in charter schools. And so with this grant not being given, it'll be interesting to see where California education heads. Now, I want to ask you to give our listeners a little bit more background. You talked about the school to prison pipeline, particularly among young people of color. Give our listeners some statistics, some facts that show that aside from all of these test scores, what are some of the very basic aspects of institutionalized racism in our public schools that have really unjustly targeted and victimized particularly young people of color?
I would recommend that your listeners go to a website that contains a very illustrative report that was just released by a collaborative of community-based organizations and activists on education reform. And it includes a lot of statistics that look at this pervasive issue of disproportionate suspension and exclusionary discipline that is being meted out to African-American students in local District 7, which is the South LA-based local district, you know, here in Los Angeles.
And it's disproportionate, meaning you compare it to what white and other students? For the same infractions?
Of other ethnicities, Latino, white, Asian.
And so for the same infractions, the black students are punished worse?
Yeah, for the same infractions, African-American students are disproportionately disciplined, moved out of classrooms, moved out of schools.
Now, is that something that teachers decide, or is it administrators?
It begins at the level of the classroom, you know, in terms of a quote-unquote infraction that has been committed by a student. It also can begin at the level of the school. So there are a number of different factors that determine how discipline is going to be meted out, but typically if a student, quote-unquote, disrupts a classroom, they may be sent out by the teacher, they may be recommended for detention, and that could escalate to suspension and being opportunity transferred to another campus.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is something that is not just epidemic within LAUSD, but it's epidemic nationwide.
Sikivu, finally, very briefly, do you agree with the UTLA in calling for a boycott of the LA Times over this?
I do, insofar as I think that the LA Times had some ulterior motives in publishing this information that ties into its attempt to achieve greater relevance in an era in which it's seen its revenue decline and its readership decline, you know, based upon its cultural irrelevance in LA and the rise of the internet. So I think that there are some other factors that are really driving the publication of these scores and the emphasis on this particular, in my view, a draconian measure of evaluating teachers that is reductive and exclusionary.
And I mentioned the UTLA is having a demonstration outside the Times' office on September 14th. We'll post that information on our website if you're interested at uprisingradio.org. And we'll also link to Sikivu Hutchinson's website, blackfemlens.org. Sikivu, as always, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali.
Sikivu Hutchinson is a senior fellow at the Institute for Humanist Studies and the editor of blackfemlens.org. For Sonali, subversive thought for the day, Sherwood Anderson, an American novelist and short story writer, said the whole object of education is to develop the mind should be a thing that works. That's Sherwood Anderson. That's Sonali. Subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our interim assistant producer. Claudio Nunez is our intern. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can order a copy of today's show at 1-800-735-0230 or go to pacificaradioarchives.org. Our website is uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8.